Welcome to The Kicker. I'm your host, Megan Greenwell. Today, my guest is Spencer Hall, the founder of Every Day Should Be Saturday, one of the OG sports blogs on the internet, now the proprietor of Channel 6 and the Shutdown Fullcast. But I wanted to talk to Spencer because he is also low-key one of the best fundraisers anywhere in the world. He and his partner in crime, Holly Anderson, run a one-week fundraiser through their website for a group in Atlanta called New American Pathways that helps refugees. And I'm really interested in how they've built a niche, tight-knit college football blog community into this absolute fundraising powerhouse. Spencer Hall, welcome to The Kicker.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm so thrilled you're here. You're here in part because you're a person I've long admired. I've read your writing since way too long. But you're mostly here because of the charity Bundy Bowl.
Yes.
I wanted to have you on to talk about this even before I realized that this is the 20th anniversary. So it's kind of perfect.
2-0. Yeah. We've done 20 of these.
Incredible. So for those who don't know, tell us what the bowl is.
The bowl is an outgrowth of the old EDSBS, Every Day Should Be Saturday community. It was a college football site that I founded and ran with Holly Anderson. And one of the things that we did one year was a little fundraiser, like online fundraiser for what a charity that became New American Pathways, which is a refugee service community, a refugee service organization in Atlanta, Georgia. And I think the first year we did it, we just set it up, said, hey, let's just give some money, raise, a couple thousand bucks and started it. But then it sort of really took off with our community, both as the community grew and as we weaponized it. I think that's maybe a harsh verb, but I'm going to go ahead and go with it because we turned it into a contest where we turned the competitiveness of college football and college football fan bases towards, I hope, a good by encouraging them to donate in a score or with a number that was meaningful to them. So if you beat your rival 70-0, then what we were going to do was say, why don't you give $70? $70. So every time somebody sees that donation amount and they are on team U, they'd say, oh, 70-0. That's right. We beat that ass. Let's go. And I'll give $70. Or if you were the rival, you'd say, oh, that makes me so angry. Here's a score from the time we beat them. People got very creative with this. And over time, it snowballed. And, last year we raised over $1 million for New American Pathways, which is proof that if you do something for 20 years, eventually, it might work. So if you want to know, hey, how do you start something like this? It's like, when is the best time to plant a tree? 20 years ago or tomorrow?
I like that. Let's go back in time a little bit. So you launched Every Day Should Be Saturday in 2005. Is that right? And what were you doing before that?
Before that, I was working as I ran the education program for a refugee service organization in Clarkston, Georgia. So this is really a callback to the career I had before I started writing about sports, and the one that I transitioned out of into writing about sports. Both were purely accidental. It just happened to be, I fell into one because I had a little bit of overseas experience and the right sort of profile. And also because I would work for very little money. If you want to know how to get into journalism in any form, I suggest you come from a field where you are making less or similar amounts of money. So nonprofit to journalism, it's really nonprofit to nonprofit when you're starting out. And that's the whole reason for this thing was, in part because I really believe in the cause of supporting refugee immigration in America and that it's part of our entire identity. And in addition to that, it is sort of like this long apology for not being as great at that job as I wanted to. You say, okay, well, I don't think I was very good at that, but maybe if I can just encourage people to give money, it'll sort of ameliorate my guilt a little bit.
You wrote a how we got here blog for Channel 6, the site you now run, about the charity Bundy Bowl. And one of the things I really like about you're writing and Holly's writing, you're both like incredibly funny. You are two of the funniest writers on the internet. You are also incredibly earnest people. And I think a lot of internet writers feel like they have to choose one lane or another. And you and Holly are so good at just like being both simultaneously. So in this How We Got Here blog, you write about working for that refugee resettlement agency in Clarkston. And you're talking about a family that you were helping where they just didn't have a window because mm-hmm. somebody had knocked it out with a rock. And so the mosquitoes were coming in. It was incredibly hot, all of that. And you write, we eventually got the window fixed, but it still got jammed in my brain. Kids slept in there every night, trying to dream in all that heat and darkness. They made it all the way here, only to find out firsthand that there are people in America who see a window and immediately search for a rock. Which is just a lovely piece of writing. But tell me a little bit about the impressions that that work left on you, you know, even now long past when you've worked in that role.
It left a number of impressions on me. One, that people really do average out to sort of a general, you know, mean. Like, people are people. It doesn't really matter who you're dealing with. They have a lot of the same motivations. They have a lot of the same concerns. And that's a cliche, but like most cliches, that you have to remind yourself of it constantly. You know, there is no, you know, when talking about dealing with an other, there's no other, right? There's no such thing as other people's kids. There's just kids. And there's no such thing as, you know, the inscrutable mind of the foreigner. You just haven't figured out what the basic motivations are in code, right? You don't understand the language, and that's on you, because generally motivations are all the same. And additionally, what shocked me is that when we bring people here, the government provides, you know, 3 months of this assistance, 6 months of this assistance, and then that's it. Our program is pretty, like, the government program is really, really lean, you know, and then it's you're on your own. That's it. And that gap is what, you know, we really sought to fill. I think what a lot of NGOs and a lot of nonprofits seek to fill is, you know, okay, how can we continue that support? Because inevitably, you know, the other impression that left on me is this, that, you know, people will succeed. They don't, like, people want to thrive. They want a pickup truck. You know, they would love to, you know, send their kids to the pool in the summer. They want all of that stuff. You know, it's this roundabout, extremely, yes, earnest and corny path to the American dream for a lot of people is real. And it's not even necessarily branded. They just want a better life for their kids and for themselves, in that order. And they will go to extraordinary lengths to make that happen. So if you went to bed at night after doing some of that work, and mind you, the work I did was fun. I worked with kids for the most part, like teens, you know, which teens get a bad rap, man. Teens are fantastic. Like, high schoolers are awesome. They want to learn. They want to know. They're very enthusiastic. And, you know, if you put a dollar in them, you get 10 back. Like, they're just all potential. And it's fantastic, you know. Also, they like it if you're a little weird. They want a little weird. They don't want massively weird. And that's another thing that's the same, right? Like, high schoolers around the world, I don't know what this sort of, like, American sentiment that high schoolers are rebellious or, you know, distant or hard to relate to. That's bullshit. Like, that's a lie. They're awesome. You just have to meet them at their level. And that's the same everywhere. It was cool. It was cool in, you know, like, kid comes from Liberia, kid comes from Afghanistan, you go, that's a 15-year-old. That's a 15-year-old. It's just a standard issue 15-year-old, right? And they all respond to, like, the same kind of stuff and have a lot of the same interest, you know. They're children, but at the same time, they're on the cusp of adulthood. And that's, like, a very interesting place to be, and it's a very interesting dynamic to work with. I enjoyed that part of the job. But the stuff I did wasn't that difficult, you know. There were people who did much more difficult stuff. And even then, you encounter things where you go, I don't often see the gears of the machinery as clearly as, you know, I did then, right? Like, then you can see and go, oh, the system we have set up for this is so inadequate to the needs of what people actually require.
So tell me about how you went from that work to being a college football blogger.
That was extremely accidental. I just got bored and always wanted to write and was always interested in writing, and sports just sort of fused at one point. And I started a website because I was bored and because I was a strange other kind of commenter. Like if you went on a regular forum, I was too much. And at one point you said, maybe this should be a monologue and not a conversation with others. And then eventually others showed up, and I just kept writing. It was a compulsion, and got very interested in this emerging kind of form, and was all over the place and was really bad at it. But, you know, like most things, if you're bad at it and you keep doing it for, you know, 15, 20 years, eventually either people will begin to believe the lie or you will actually get better at it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of those two things happened. I'm not really sure which.
And how did you and Holly originally link up? Did she start writing for Every Day Should Be Saturday?
She was a commenter. And then we virtually met, and then we started talking. And I think both of us are on the record saying we don't remember the first time we really interacted.
Nice.
It always was. There was no real beginning. I suspect it was probably a Deadspin access point that Deadspin linked to EDSBS, and then that went that way. But yeah, I believe that's how it started.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It's such like a time marker that you met in the comment section. Like Holly came out of the comment section. Drew McGarry came out of the comment section. Like it's such a proud tradition, and it's a little hard for me to imagine professional writers coming out of the comment sections these days, just because the internet has changed so much, but I hope it's still happening.
I think it probably happens. It happens in different avenues now, not necessarily the comment section, but I believe it happens. I believe it can still happen on social media. I think it can still happen. I think it still happens like on YouTube. This is where I found people have a real, they have a real illiteracy when it comes to how YouTube works, especially if you're old school, word first internet. YouTubers are highly social and they do this kind of, hey, I made a video based off this video, all this stuff. And they've never really stopped doing that. You know, I feel like that's something that platforms prevented in a way that YouTube never really took the walls down. So I think that still happens a lot, you know, but yeah, definitely. Like it's, I can't see that happening in the comment section now.
So you start the fundraiser just a year after starting Every Day Should Be Saturday. You alluded to this, but tell me a little bit more about how it went from just like a, hey, chip in money at this particular moment to like what it is now, where the team rivalry is like the entire scaffolding of the thing.
I think that's primarily Holly. If I were to say like who pushed that, like I had that idea, but in terms of, especially over the last 10 years or so, there hasn't been anyone who has been as instrumental in like pushing that notion, promoting it, really sort of encouraging a growth of like this entire sort of culture of charity around it. It's a very, very specific garden tending kind of thing. And, you know, that's all her, you know, that's her. And then through her, the sort of extension to the people that we've got helping us out, because there's a crew behind the scenes that just donates their time once a year to manning this kind of machine that we've created. And now we have like, there's like a live scoreboard. There's all of these little widgets behind the scenes. And, you know, those are all things that I'm too stupid to do. Like I can't figure any of that out, but fortunately Holly can. And then through her, the people that we've sort of recruited to help out can as well.
Okay. So for people who still are like, so what is this? You're like supporting your team, but you're also donating to this refugee organization. Will you explain like the nuts and bolts of how it works? Like you go on the platform, you want to donate. What do you see? What choices are you making?
Yeah. So you would go to edsbscharitybowl.com. And what you're going to see is, you know, a brief explanation, some FAQs about what we're doing, raising money for New American Pathways. And we will, you know, turn spite into charity. We will go ahead and say, I need you to, given the name of your FBS school, right? There's a couple schools that aren't FBS, but most of them are FBS. So it's like 136 or 8 schools. And we need you to give in the form of a number that is meaningful, something that they really value, something, you know, like the total, like people get very creative. You get like, you know, we had Oklahoma State, you know, people giving like $2,400 for like the total number of yards that Barry Sanders had in a season, or, you know, I'll get pretty arcane when it comes to like, I gave the distance that Marco Wilson threw his shoe against LSU. It was like the number of feet he threw the shoe in the game losing personal foul penalty, because we have to celebrate that as well as fans. But you're going to do that. You're going to pick a school. You'll enter the amount. You enter your payment information. There's a little, you know, you can, there's a little space where you can dedicate it to somebody. Encourage you to do that. And then we take that information and we tally it so that, you know, if you gave in the name of the University of Florida, it goes to Florida. You know, so there's $100 on the board for Florida, or there's $1,000 on the board for Florida. Hopefully there's like $100,000 on the board for Florida this year. I don't, you know, that would be a record, but I believe in my people. And that is how we run it. And we give update after update after update. And the fun part with the data of the last couple of years is that we can parse that out into, you know, individual rivalries. We can, you know, sort of do that and go, okay, well, here's Michigan versus Ohio State. And here's how they're stacking up, right? Or here's how the SEC versus the Big Ten. Like, we can do that. And that's sort of, I think, pushed donations as well and encouraged people to get excited about things, mm-hmm. because you know, we're sports people. We like a score and we like to be able to go ahead and drill down. Unfortunately, like, you know, the general trajectory of sports fandom is to become even more obsessed with numbers than we previously were. Mm-hmm. And we can play into that.
And for listeners who are not sports people, I think one thing that's like super relevant here is like sports fans are ritualistic people in mm-hmm. general, but I think college football fans are the most ritualistic potentially and the most rivalry driven. Like mm-hmm. fans of NFL teams like Ravens fans don't like the Steelers, but it doesn't feel the same to me as the way in which Michigan fans hate Ohio State. And so it feels like this version of a fundraiser actually, to me, kind of doesn't work with anything but college football. Does that feel true?
I think that is, how's this? I'll give that a rating, mostly true.
Great, I'll take it.
You could probably do this in Spanish with soccer. True. I think you could probably do that. I think you might be able to do it in England. I think you might be able, there's certain spots where I think you could do it. I think the key is some sense of strong identity, you know, and it's very hard, I think, as an NFL fan to have an identity that's not you. Like your primary identity as an NFL fan isn't, oh, you know, we Steelers fans. Who's that? That could be anybody, right? You know, it's, sure, it's probably somebody from Pittsburgh, but like there's Steeler fans out in like Glendale, Arizona. Yeah. You know, there's, I think, a stronger sense of regionalized identity out of college football. And I think that's a good point when you understand how this works, because the tribalism is both really real, really intense, and very specific. You know, mm-hmm. I think in the NFL it can be equally intense. I think there's rivalries, especially, you know, when you talk about like Steelers Ravens or something like that, or hey, Raiders Chargers is real. People get stabbed over that rivalry. I've seen footage of a guy getting stabbed at a Raiders Chargers game. So it's that real. I get it, and all respect to that. But I think in terms of, I can't say that the Pittsburgh Steelers and Baltimore Ravens also have a softball rivalry. I can't say that they also have a basketball rivalry, right? This is why I think the only other place this would work are these kind of areas like Turkey, right? Like in Turkey, where you have a wheelchair basketball game riot influences the outcome of attendance at a soccer game, mm-hmm. you know, like because there's a Fenerbahce basketball and then there's a Fenerbahce soccer. It's like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like
that. And you went to the University of Florida.
I did.
Holly never shuts up about the University of Tennessee.
As she shouldn't.
I didn't go to, but I'm a big fan of the University of Kentucky. These are three Cats. Schools that like
Cats,
really dislike each other in general, which is fun. Like I love, just as a viewer, like watching you and Holly on the internet, like jaw back and forth
mm-hmm.
about your teams. And I yeah. like when screenshots go around from the bowl of people putting clever things, you know, roasting whatever team it is. I don't care if it's mine.
Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
that's fun.
Oh, it has to be fun. And yeah. it has to have the exact right pH. You know, it has to be like slightly acidic.
Yeah.
Right. It's got to have a little tang to it.
Yes. Totally.
I like that. I like that. I like, for instance, that, you know, we get LSU fans are very good at coming up with very specific roasts for people. I don't know what it is. Right. Mm-hmm. Georgia fans will come up with one and then they'll all do it because they have this like hive mind where they just sort of shuffle around their talking point. You know, God love them. But yeah, I love that. I think it's an important part of the sport. I think it also, I love the fact now, especially that I'm older, you can get lore. Like, it's great. Yes. People love lore. Like, why do people watch the third Game of Thrones show? It's because they love lore, man. Mm-hmm. Like, why are we on, like, the third reboot of the second reboot of The Lord of the Rings as an like a commercial franchise of The Hobbit as a commercial? Because, man, people like the side notes. College mm-hmm. football's got side notes, man. We've got, like, there's lore, and then there's deeper lore, and then there's just this obscure stuff that only 2% of the people care about.
Yeah. You know?
Like, hey, today, Dickie Lyons, the Dickie report came back. The Dickie Lyons was a wide receiver for Kentucky back in, like, 07, I want to say, 08. And yeah. he would do this, like, hey, man. It's like early internet video. He's like, hey, man, Dickie reporting here. Hot day out here. And, you know, he just come on and say nothing. And it was great because it was just, he's a very charming, very funny country dude. And Dickie Lyons today, for the first time in 17 years, did a Dickie report with his son, Dickie Lyons III, live from the new practice facility at Kentucky, where he was surveying Will Stein's spring practices. So just a great, like, deep lore. That's, wow. that's what we've got here.
More news. I love this.
Yeah.
Okay, well, this gets to one thing I wanted to ask you about, which is for a while, Every Day Should Be Saturday was owned by Vox Media,
mm-hmm.
and then it turned into Banner Society at Vox Media, and then, yep. as things often do at Vox Media, everything fell apart. And mm-hmm. the quote Holly always likes to use from that era, from somebody in Vox management, was that they were getting rid of you guys, scaling you down, whatever, because it was too niche.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, like, on one hand, college football is not really niche at all.
No.
And on the other hand, like, the nicheness of what you are doing with this fundraiser is the entire reason it works. So yeah. I don't even know what my question is, but can you talk about too niche a little bit?
Yeah. I think that person and a lot of other people at a big media company were set up to fail because really, niche is the only energy. I don't, if you look at the numbers for what constitutes a big live stream, I feel like maybe the metrics of the industry have finally caught up to that notion. Because if you look at what counts as the metrics for a big live stream, they're numbers that would have had broadcast TV killing themselves
mm-hmm.
if they'd gotten them. And those are numbers that can support like an entire little industry. If you look at what builds an audience now. Mm-hmm. And I think that they were set up to fail because anytime you're backed by venture capital, a thing that you know a lot about as the author of a book on the subject, a really good one, by the way, that was fun.
Thank you.
But as somebody, if you're backed by that, the returns that they'll demand, they all but guarantee failure.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way you can be 10x to people if you're doing something that people identify this personally with. It's not possible, you know, which is good and bad news. Bad news is that you don't get the easy money that, say, Vox got to build a YouTube channel where it said, oh, here's just a bunch of cash. Why don't you guys see what you can do?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Which, to people listening to this, if you're young or maybe if you're older and haven't had the experience, if somebody just hands you a bunch of cash, you have 3 years. You have 3 years. That's it.
God, that's so true.
If you build it on your own, you have as long as you need, man. If you make it work at your scale, and if you do that, that's fine. That's fine. It'll be hard. Might fail, but you'll fail on your own terms. If you get a bunch of cash from somebody, that's cool, but you got 3 years. And after that, They're cutting, buddy. They're getting out of there. And you'll probably fail because there's absolutely no way that 99% of the people are doing that, are bringing those kind of returns. So when I talk about niche, you know, I'm pretty passionate about it because that's me and that's Holly and that's most everyone I admire who does this for a living, you know? And I say that, by the way, that's like, that's managed it like sports people come closer. You have nothing on nerds. You have nothing. Like when you talk about, oh, hey, I got a successful little video channel here. Are you a Warhammer Lord channel with 300,000 subscribers? No, no, you are a fly, buddy, on the back of an elephant called nerddom. Nerddom. There are people out there who, you know, make a living unboxing vintage toys. And there are people who are like, yeah, that vintage toy guy, I miss when he was real. You know, like there are people out there who are engaged in things far bigger than what you think about the draft. You know, that's like, I've become a late life Warhammer devotee. And I will tell you that one side effect of doing that is realizing there's people out there who are way, not only way better at this as a thing that like I'm interested in, but that they've been better at this for a really long time, and that they do a lot of stuff that I think that, you know, it's always my brain. I quit being a manager a long time ago, and I quit being like a creative director a long time ago, but that reflex is still there. So I still see stuff and go, "Ooh, that's good. We should steal it." And you go, "Ooh, we should, you know, we should take that." So like, and that's a niche, and that's a massive niche that people just don't know it's, they don't, they probably don't know it's there because, you know, they're not interested and they're not looking.
So say a little bit about what it's been like to build a company on your own. You've got Channel 6, you've got the Shutdown Fullcast. It's been, what, since 2019, 2020?
2020, yeah.
Okay, great. So 6 years. I want to hear about the process.
The process is, it's a lot like getting out in a lifeboat and then realizing, okay, we have to sail on our own. And also, this is the only boat I have. And it's not meant for this. You have to figure out how to function as a team of two or as a team of four. And that's been great, actually. Like, it's scary at times when you go, okay, everything depends on this. But at the same time, you're really only accountable to you. And that, I think, forces you to mature in a number of ways that maybe you didn't before, because, you know, a big company, you show up and it's, somebody does this for me and somebody does that for me and somebody takes care of HR and somebody takes care of, you know, the insurance and somebody takes care of, you know, there's not just an editor, but there's also somebody to get art ready for you on big stuff. That's crazy. Wow. In a lot of ways, it is kind of like a retro move because it's almost like working off of Blogspot or like working off of, you know, an early open source platform for what you want to do. At the same time, it's a lot easier. It's there are a lot of tools out there that just make things much, much simpler, really. And the luxury that we have is that we have an audience that has gone with us and has really like ridden hard for us and supported us financially and in terms of just opening the email. Thank you for opening the email. You know, and it has been very vocal in terms of what they like or what they don't like. That's the best part, you know. And I think that's the part that probably that's where time and age and commitment have come in, because we have a lot of people who you know, have been following us for 10, 20 years. The challenge, I think, is, you know, you don't want to say, hey, I want to expand this audience or find new audience. No, no, no. Occasionally you would like for people to, if they want to, come through, engage, become a part of the community. That's cool. I don't think you want to change what you're doing too much, because then you just get off map. Yeah. It helps to have a great partner in that at Channel 6, and that everybody at the full cast has been cool as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you know immediately when you went back independent that it would work financially? Like, you have kids, you have like real obligations in the world.
Yeah.
Were you like 100% this will work? It had worked for you before.
Yeah, not at all. No, I had no idea.
Huh.
You know, that was just kind of the only chance, the only like route that I saw, because this is just talking about me. I think I am niche. You know, I think I am, I don't want to say a cult figure, but I'm not, you know, Adam Schefter. Mm-hmm. I'm not even, I'm not even, you know, like an ESPN.com writer. You know, I'm just over here. And that's the only thing I can be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's fantastic. Like, I have friends who write for The New Yorker or for The Atlantic, and I'm in awe of them. Because I'm like, how do you do that? I don't. I couldn't, you know. How do you write with an outline? That's crazy. I just have to hack at it, and all of a sudden it sort of works. Or it doesn't, which also happens. Mm-hmm. You know. So it was never, I don't feel like I had another option. But fortunately, I also feel like if you're that kind of person, there aren't too many people who can do what you do. Like, even if you do it badly. Right. And you're like, wow, you do the weird thing and you do it badly, or you do this, you know, offbeat or otherwise off cut thing. I like off cut. Off cut's a better thing when you go, hey, the factory made this and it's a little weird, but I kind of like it, you know, even though it's technically a mistake. That kind of thing, there's not many people who can do it mm-hmm. or consistently do it. So, you know, it was the only real sort of option I think that we had, right? That I had. You know, I don't include Holly in that because Holly can work anywhere and she's brilliant and she can adapt to that kind of thing. You know, like Holly worked at Grantland, right? Mm-hmm. I would have been fired at Grantland in 3 weeks.
She worked at MTV too. She's really,
she worked at MTV, man. She had this whole like career in editing, like, and was a great, like, like video editor before, you know, she understands people and can work on. I'm not housebroken. You know, like, I'm not. I think that's, by the way, like, roundabout when you meet journalists and writers, you really start to appreciate, if you notice, you go, oh, man, I didn't think that person was cool, but then I realized they do this. You know, like, I can't do that. That's what I realized in sports with, like, reporters. You'd be at a press conference and go, oh, I don't know what to ask. God, how do you get any information out of this guy? And then you'd see an actual reporter work and go, oh, that's how.
All right, I want to go back to the bowl specifically. So talk me through a little bit the growth over time in the actual amount you were fundraising in rough terms. Like, what was it at the beginning? What was the trajectory? But I want you to stop after 2023, because then I'm going to ask about 2024.
Yeah, I think that's it started to sort of creep up over time. You know, it was like, you raise a couple of thousand here, then okay, we're over 10,000. Okay, cool. And then, you know, by, I want to say like 2014, 2015, you know, like, you start getting impressive numbers. You go, okay, well, that's like an actual real sort of, you know, donor amount. And then by the time we hit like 2018, 2019, moving into early 2020s, you know, we're a grantor. Like, we're an actual size that would indicate like, oh, that's a line item on a budget.
Like, what kind of numbers?
We started to get to the hundreds of thousands mm-hmm. at that point. But I'm leading up to 2023, because there's kind of a watershed where this starts to like push big time.
So tell me about the watershed.
That's when we start to get into the like, okay, are we actually going to start to push a million? And I don't really know what the single catalyst was, because we did have big years during, say, the first Trump administration, when, you know, they make their sort of hostility to not just the refugee program, but to all forms of migration mm-hmm. and immigration known. And they start to take concrete steps towards it and really put pressure on the, like, nonprofit community to respond. And, you know, we had big years then. But, you know, at one point it was like, okay, are we going to do it? Are we actually going to raise $1 million, which is an unfathomable number, you know, based on the roots, you know, starting with like a couple of grand back in, you know, 07, 08, that kind of thing. And then it happened. And
2024, right?
Yeah, I believe it was 2024.
I think it was 2024. And I should say that the initial goal you guys set in 2024 was 500,000. Like, obviously, yeah, you got to set an initial goal a little conservative, but mm-hmm. there was no indication that you guys were going to cross a million.
No, no. And, you know, even there was something that happened in 24 where even those numbers that we had seen sort of come to rely on. Big donations from Michigan, a couple of big donors from other schools, you know, they'd double or they'd triple. And it was astonishing. I think the coolest thing I've seen is that if you see someone dunk and you see someone donate like a substantial sum of money, then somebody else said, "That's cool. Watch this." And then they would do it as well. And I think people like to be generous, but they also really like to compete. Mm-hmm. And that was thrilling to me because I like watching people start to do that. We also had, you know, a lot of the trends that we'd observed, you know, would intensify to degrees that we didn't really expect, like our Friday run, like typically Monday, Tuesdays, you know, big, big, big. Then Wednesday, Thursday kind of tamps down. Then Friday's a push, right? Either people get paid or, you know, they go, "Oh, okay, I forgot to donate. So here's, you know, my donation. I'll finally kick it in." Our Fridays were huge. Friday was immense. Like we could not stop. It felt runaway. And that was 24 and that was 25. So I'm hoping we see that again. I think people are very motivated, just both by current events and by, I think, the habit that they built up over time. You know, we have people who plan for this now.
So collectively, the donors to the bowl are now the single largest non-governmental donor to New American Pathways. That is right. Total. I also just have to underscore, I'm sure you mentioned this at some point, but when you're talking about days of the week, this is a single week we are talking about. The entire event only lasts a week. It's scheduled to last Monday through Friday, and then sometimes it gets extended. Most of the time it gets extended to Monday. Is that the deal?
Yeah. We started, it's called the Dark Match, you know, which is a wrestling reference. The cameras aren't on for that. We don't really sort of provide updates.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, okay, hey, whatever you throw in for the weekend, we will count, you know, which is kind of fun because for the donor and for the person who follows along with it, you know, like on Monday, who knows what you'll wake up with.
Right. So last year you guys raised $1.37 million.
Yeah.
In a week.
Yeah, our community kicked in $1.3 million in a week. Yeah.
It is sort of wild on one level to me, and I'm not like blowing smoke. On some level, this should be like the biggest fundraising story in the world because that is insane. I've never heard of that happening anywhere else.
First of all, that's a testament to that's a testament to the commitment I think our community has to charity giving, the notion of community itself, that people would do that for people they don't even know.
Mm-hmm.
Or won't know, you know, and that's very moving to me. That is, I'm not a religious person, but that's about as close as I come to it, that it would be a greater good only if you would do it with no one looking or for someone whose name you would never know. And I love that. Yeah. That's my favorite thing, that there's that many people willing to jump in. You know, it's the breach and people will 100% go right into it for a cause. And I love that. Mm-hmm. A good cause. I also love that I don't think we get enough publicity, not because I really want people to know what an awesome group of people we are. I mean, I will tell you all day how awesome, you know, Holly and Dan and Joy and Stephanie and Andrew and everyone else who helps out with the bowl and Hector. They're awesome and it would not happen without them or the people who help out with it. You know, whether it's Mina Kimes and Monty Jones, who've always been like 100% down for the bowl, or Mike Gulick Jr., who manages to round up the troops and lead the way for Notre Dame every year. Which I hate. I have to say nice things about Notre Dame.
Sure.
You know, there's some that I like playfully hate, but I'm like, I gotta admit that you guys do good shit. I hate it. But you know, I understand that it's kind of hard to wrap your head around that there's like in a week we could raise $1 million. But I assure you it happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody wants to talk about it, just call me right up.
Mm-hmm.
That'd be awesome. I'd be happy to talk about it.
So speaking of rooting for teams you don't necessarily like in other contexts, we should talk about the University of Michigan. The University of Michigan has won this competition, I mean, certainly as long as I can remember. Do you know when the first time they won was?
I'm pretty sure it was year one.
They've always won.
Yeah. They are on one of the most impressive dynastic streaks in sports, because they just every single year they absolutely hammer it. And now it's, you know, not only, by the way, they like to do that because, you know, they get to say, you know, we're rich, we're cool, we're charitable, you know. But now I think it's just another trophy, man. Now they're like, yeah, that's what we do. Championship U. Here we go. You know, they have both large donors, but also the majority of what they have thrown in is small donors. You know, so that community is different, man. There are other schools that give, and other schools that give generously, and then there are individual donors for other schools who give outrageous amounts of money, and I love and appreciate all of them. Michigan continues to outstrip my wildest expectations of what's possible.
And as a result of this, how many University of Michigan tattoos do you have on your body?
I'll show you. Oh, I wore the shirt that kind of like, all right, this is a little not safe for work, but so I have one here.
Okay.
Which that is a Wolverine with a top hat.
Sure.
And a monocle.
Cool.
And then I have over here, that's Totoro.
Oh, wow.
With the University of Michigan M. So okay. I have two so far.
As a graduate of the University of Florida, the only reason you have these tattoos, to clarify, is because of this bowl, yeah?
Yeah, that's it. Okay. Yeah, that's the sole reason. They're the only tattoos I have.
Are they really?
Yeah, it's the only tats I've got. Yeah, like...
Oh, wow.
My boy Jason from the full cast is like actually properly tatted up. He's got like real ink, beautiful work. Me, I just have these two. Might get a third. I don't know. You know, I really should have like a gainer one somewhere on my body at one point.
I mean, it feels fair. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there's like, do I really want to rep the state of Florida real hard when I have no intention of going back? Mm-hmm. Not really. But an alligator is a cool tat, so I might do that.
But in second place last year, maybe the year before, was a university that does not exist. And there are many, you know, there are, speaking of the lore, like there are many universities that do not exist that get support in the bowl every year that are like jokes going back decades. But in the last couple of years, the biggest among them has been Protect Trans Kids University. So can you talk a little bit about the genesis of Protect Trans Kids University and how they became like a reliable top finisher in the standings?
They became that because we have a number of commenters, who are deeply committed to trans rights and wanted a way to sort of channel that. And there was a time in the bowl when you could just enter whatever school you wanted to. You know, we're playing a new game this year. We're not doing that anymore. We have grandfathered in several of them, including PTKU, because they are such a solid voting block in terms of donations. But that's, PTKU has now got merch. They have a mascot. They're the Sharks.
With the little like trans flag jersey.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got kit. They've got gear. Like, we will at one point see a PTKU jersey in the wild. I don't know when, but someone's going to make one and wear it to a show. Absolutely certain that's going to happen. I'll be thrilled when I see it. But they're grandfathered in. They can stay. That's because that's a big community. It's enormous. And, I am pleased that they feel 100% like comfortable with us, and that they feel like that they can manifest their charity for somebody else entirely, right? Like for refugees. Like I love that confluence of groups.
So we're recording this on the Friday before the bowl starts. This will air on the Thursday of bowl week. So people listening to it, you're going to have a couple of days. Mm-hmm. What are your dreams, hopes, expectations for this year?
I always have no expectations whatsoever. Like, I am always nervous that we won't get to $10. Right. And we inevitably do within seconds, but, my expectation is that if you're listening to this right now, you would go to edsbscharityball.com. You would pick a school that you have a deep relationship with, and you would pick a number that was meaningful to you. Hey, did Dad have seats in row 13? And was it the 25th seat next year? Congratulations. You are giving $13.25, or better yet, $132.50. I will upsell you. Okay. Yeah. If you listen to this podcast, you're a little highfalutin. Okay. You got some airs about you. So your donation should have those as well. $132.50. But if you got 13 bucks, we'll take 13. 13's great. Most of our donors are around that if you average it out. But you'll do that and you'll donate to the EDSBS charity bowl. And then you'll see number go up. And if we know anything about Americans, we love it when line go up. And line go up if you donate to the EDSBS charity bowl and give to a worthy cause like New American Pathways.
I mean, I know I'm going to give $168 for the 168 yards that Cutter Bowley threw for the University of Kentucky against the University of Florida last year. So that I'm just, you know, stating for the record, that's where
Megan,
I'm going.
That's so good, because honestly, I'm a little pissed off that that's what you're going to do. And that's what you should do.
That's the point.
That's like, I'm a little ticked, and that's good. That shows that you know ball. You understand the game.
Thank you. All right, I have one last question for you, and it's like sort of a philosophical one. When I have told people, I've been fascinated by the bowl for years, as I've told you, and when I've told people about it who are not college sports fans and don't know college sports internet, often their reaction is sort of like, wow, wouldn't expect that from college sports bros, you know, because it's like raising money for refugees and like naming your team in honor of protecting trans kids and all of that. I assume this is a response you have gotten too from people who don't follow college football. So I'm just curious how you respond to that when people say it to you.
It's a big world, man. It's a big world. You might be wrong about some of it. You know, I would prefer to rely on what is. And I love being and leading at least one little example of that, because like, I don't do that much. I just sort of point. And there's a whole sea of people out there who not only believe in this cause, but believe in this entire sort of like notion of community beyond your front door, you know? And I love that. So that would be how I would respond. I would be like, hey, I love that you're surprised by that. I do, but I'm not. It means that better things are possible. And if somebody's surprised by that, I hope you had a day of learning today.
Perfect note to end on. Spencer, thank you. I hope you beat last year's record, fueled in part by Cutter Bowley, obviously.
Yeah.
Good luck out there.
Hey, you saw our football team. We're going to need it.
It's true. Thanks for coming.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. The Kicker is a production of the Columbia Journalism Review. I'm your host, Megan Greenwell, and our producer is Amanda Dara. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, and we'd love if you liked and subscribed. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.